Victory. 1. Those who saw him descend from the Marseille Express in the Gare de Lyon on that damp morning saw a tall man, a little stiff, with a bronze face and spike-ended mustaches and almost white hair. "A milord," they said, remarking his sober, correct suit, his correct stick, correctly carried, his sparse baggage. "A milord military, but there is something the matter with his eyes." But there was something the matter with the eyes of so many people, men and women too, in Europe since 4 years now. So they watched him go on, a half head above the French people, with his gaunt, strained eyes, his air strained, purposeful, and at the same time assured, and vanish into a cab, thinking, if they thought about him any more at all, "You will see him in the legation offices, or at a table on the boulevard, or in a carriage with the fine English ladies in the bois." That was all. And those who saw him descend from the same cab at the Gare du Nord, they thought, "This milord returns home by haste." The porter who took his bag wished him good morning in fair English, and told him that he was going to England, receiving for reply the English glare which the porter perhaps expected, and put him into a first-class carriage of the boat train. And that was all, too. That was all right, too. Even when he got down at Amiens. English milords even did that. It was only at Rosières that they began to look at him, and after him, when he had passed. In a hired car he jounced through a gutted street between gutted walls, rising undoored and unwindowed in jagged shards in the dusk. The street was partially blocked, now and then, by toppled walls, with masses of masonry in the cracks of which a thin grass sprouted, passing empty and ruined courtyards, in one of which a tank, mute and tilted, rusted among rank weeds. This was Rosières, but he didn't stop there because no one lived there, and there was no place to stop. So the car jounced and crept on out of the ruin. The muddy and unpaved street entered a village of harsh new brick and sheet iron and tarred paper roofs made in America, and halted before the tallest house. It was flush with the street, a brick wall with a door and one window of American glass bearing the word "Restaurant." "Here you are, sir," the driver said. The passenger descended with his bag, his ulster, his correct stick. He entered a biggish, bare room, chill with new plaster. It contained a billiard table at which three men played. One of the men looked over his shoulder and said, "Bonjour, monsieur." The newcomer did not reply at all. He crossed the room, passing the new zinc bar, and approached an open door beyond which a woman of any age, around 40, looked at him above the sewing on her lap. "Bonjour, madame," he said. "Dormi, madame." The woman gave him a single glance, brief, still. "C'est ça, monsieur," she said, rising. "Dormi, madame," he said, raising his voice a little. His spiked mustache beaded a little with rain, dampness beneath his strained yet assured eyes. "Dormi, madame." "Bon, monsieur," the woman said. "Bon, bon." "Dor—" the newcomer essayed again. Someone touched his arm. It was the man who had spoken from the billiard table when he entered. "Regardez, Monsieur Langlais," the man said. He took the bag from the newcomer and swept his other arm toward the ceiling. "La chambre." He touched the traveler again. He laid his face upon his palm and closed his eyes. He gestured again toward the ceiling and went on across the room toward a wooden stair without balustrade. As he passed the bar, he took a candle stub from it and lit the candle. The big room and the room beyond the door where the woman sat were lighted by single bulbs hanging naked on cords from the ceiling, at the foot of the stair. They mounted, thrusting their fitful shadows before them into a corridor, narrow, chill, and damp as a tomb. The walls were of rough plaster not yet dried. The floor was of pine without carpet or paint. Cheap metal doorknobs glinted symmetrically. The sluggish air lay like a hand upon the very candle. They entered a room, smelling too of wet plaster, and even colder than the corridor. A sluggish chill, almost substantial, as though the atmosphere between the dead and recent walls were congealing, like a patent 3-minute dessert. The room contained a bed, a dresser, a chair, a washstand. The bowl, pitcher, and slop basin were of American enamel. When the traveler touched the bed, the linen was soundless under his hand, coarse as sacking, clinging damply to the hand in the dead air in which their two breathings vaporized in the faint candle. The host set the candle on the dresser. "Dîner, monsieur?" he said. The traveler stared down at the host, incongruous in his correct clothes, with that strained air. His waxed mustaches gleamed like faint bayonets above a cravat, striped with what the host could not have known was the patterned coloring of a Scottish regiment. "Mangez!" the host shouted. He chewed violently in pantomime. "Mangez!" he roared, his shadow aping his gesture as he pointed toward the floor. "Yes!" the traveler shouted in reply, their faces not a yard apart. "Yes! Yes!" The host nodded violently, pointed toward the floor and then at the door, nodded again, went out. He returned below stairs. He found the woman now in the kitchen at the stove.
"He will eat," the host said.
"I knew that," the woman said.
"You would think that they would stay at home," the host said. "I'm glad I was not born of a race doomed to a place too small to hold all of us at one time."
"Perhaps he has come to look at the war," the woman said.
"Of course he has," the host said. "But he should have come 4 years ago. That was when we needed Englishmen to look at the war."
"He was too old to come then," the woman said. "Didn't you see his hair?"
"Then let him stay at home now," the host said. "He is no younger."
"He may have come to look at the grave of his son," the woman said.
"Him?" the host said. "That one? He is too cold to ever have had a son."
"Perhaps you are right," the woman said. "After all, that is his affair. It is our affair only that he has money."
"That's right," the host said. "A man in this business, he cannot pick and choose."
"He can pick, though," the woman said.
"Good," the host said. "Very good. Pick. That is worth telling to the English himself."
"Why not let him find it out when he leaves?"
"Good," the host said. "Better still. Good. Oh, good."
"Attention," the woman said. "Here he comes."
They listened to the traveler's steady tramp. Then he appeared in the door. Against the lesser light of the bigger room, his dark face and his white hair looked like a Kodak negative. The table was set for two, a carafe of red wine at each place. As the traveler seated himself, the other guest entered and took the other place, a small, rat-faced man who appeared at first glance to have no eyelashes at all. He tucked his napkin into the top of his vest and took up the soup ladle. The tureen sat between them in the center of the table, and offered it to the other.
"Faites-moi l'honneur, monsieur," he said.
The other bowed stiffly, accepting the ladle. The small man lifted the cover from the tureen.
"Vous venez examiner ce scène de nos victoires, monsieur?" he said, helping himself in turn.
The other looked at him.
"Monsieur l'Anglais a peut-être beaucoup des amis qui sont tombés en voisinage."
"I speak no French," the other said, eating.
The little man did not eat. He held his yet unwetted spoon above his bowl.
"What agreeable for me. I speak the English. I am Swiss, me. I speak all lang."
The other did not reply. He ate steadily, not fast.
"You have returned to see the grave of your gallant countrymen, eh? You have son here, perhaps, eh?"
"No,"
the other said. He did not cease to eat.
"No?"
The other finished his soup and set the bowl aside. He drank some wine.
"What deplorable that man who have," the Swiss said. "But it is finished now, not?"
Again the other said nothing. He was not looking at the Swiss. He did not seem to be looking at anything, with his gaunt eyes, his rigid mustaches upon his rigid face.
Me, I suffer too, all suffer. But I tell myself, what would you? It is war.
Still the other did not answer. He ate steadily, deliberately, and finished his meal, and rose and left the room. He lit his candle at the bar where the host, leaning beside a second man in a corduroy coat, lifted a glass slightly to him.
Au bon dormir, monsieur, the host said.
The traveler looked at the host, his face gaunt in the candle, his waxed mustaches rigid, his eyes in shadow.
What?
He said.
Yes, yes.
He turned and went toward the stairs. The two men at the bar watched him, his stiff, deliberate back. Ever since the train left Arras, the two women had been watching the other occupant of the carriage. It was a third-class carriage because no first-class trains ran on this line, and they sat with their shawled heads and the thick, still hands of peasants folded upon closed baskets on their laps, watching the man sitting opposite them. The white distinction of the hair against the bronze, gaunt face, the needles of the mustaches, the foreign-made suit and the stick, on a worn and greasy wooden seat, looking out the window. At first they had just looked, ready to avert their gaze, but as the man did not seem to be aware of them, they began to whisper quietly to one another behind their hands. But the man did not seem to notice this, so they soon were talking in undertone, watching with bright, alert, curious eyes the stiff, incongruous figure leaning a little forward on the stick, looking out a foul window beyond which there was nothing to see save an occasional shattered road and man-high stump of shattered tree, breaking small patches of tilled land, whirled with apparent unreason about islands of earth indicated by low signboards painted red, the islands inscrutable, desolate above the destruction which they wombed. Then the train, slowing, ran suddenly among tumbled brick, out of which rose a small house of corrugated iron bearing a name in big letters. They watched the man lean forward.
See, one of the women said, his mouth. He is reading the name. What did I tell you? It is, as I said, his son fell here. Then he had lots of sons, the other woman said. He has read the name each time since we left Arras. Eh, eh. Him a son, that cold? They do get children, though. That is why they drink whiskey. Otherwise, that's so. They think of nothing save money and eating, the English.
Presently they got out. The train went on. Then others entered the carriage, other peasants with muddy boots carrying baskets, or live or dead beasts. They in turn watched the rigid, motionless figure leaning at the window while the train ran across the ruined land and past the brick or iron stations among the tumbled ruins, watching his lips move as he read the names.
Let him look at the war, about which he has apparently heard at last, they told one another. Then he can go home. It was not in his barnyard that it was fought.
Nor in his house, a woman said.
The battalion stands at ease in the rain. It has been in rest billets 2 days. Equipment has been replaced and cleaned, vacancies have been filled and the ranks closed up. And it now stands at ease with the stupid docility of sheep in the ceaseless rain, facing the streaming shape of the sergeant major. Presently the colonel emerges from a door across the square. He stands in the door a moment, fastening his trench coat, then, followed by two ADCs, he steps gingerly into the mud in polished boots and approaches.
Parajan!
The sergeant major shouts. The battalion clashes, a single, muffled, sullen sound. The sergeant major turns, takes a pace toward the officers and salutes, his stick beneath his armpit. The colonel jerks his stick toward his cap peak.
Stand at ease, men, he says.
Again the battalion clashes, a single, sluggish, trickling sound. The officers approach the guide file of the first platoon, the sergeant major falling in behind the last officer. The sergeant of the first platoon takes a pace forward and salutes. The colonel does not respond at all. The sergeant falls in behind the sergeant major, and the five of them passed down the company front, staring in turn at each rigid, forward-staring face as they pass it. First company. The sergeant salutes the colonel's back and returns to his original position and comes to attention. The sergeant of the second company has stepped forward, saluted, is ignored, and falls in behind the sergeant major, and they pass down the second company front. The colonel's trench coat sheathes water onto his polished boots. Mud from the earth creeps up his boots and meets the water, and is channeled by the water as the mud creeps up the polished boots again. Third company. The colonel stops before a soldier, his trench coat hunched about his shoulders where the rain trickles from the back of his cap, so that he looks somehow like a choleric and outraged bird. The other two officers, the sergeant major and the sergeant, halt in turn, and the five of them glare at the five soldiers whom they are facing. The five soldiers stare rigid and unwinking straight before them, their faces like wooden faces, their eyes like wooden eyes. "Sergeant," the colonel says in his pettish voice, "has this man shaved today?"
"Sir,"
the sergeant says in a ringing voice. The sergeant major says,
"Did this man shave today, sergeant?"
And all five of them glare now at the soldier, whose rigid gaze seems to pass through and beyond them, as if they were not there.
"Take a pace forward when you speak in ranks,"
the sergeant major says. The soldier, who has not spoken, steps out of ranks, splashing a jet of mud yet higher up the colonel's boots.
"What is your name?" the colonel says. 024186, Gray,"
the soldier raps out glibly. The company, the battalion, stares straight ahead.
"Sir!"
the sergeant major thunders.
"Sir!"
the soldier says.
"Did you shave this morning?"
the colonel says.
"Nay, sir."
"Why not?"
"I dinna shave, sir."
"You don't shave? I am nae old enough to shave."
"Sir!"
the sergeant major thunders.
"Sir!"
the soldier says.
"You are not..."
The colonel's voice dies somewhere behind his choleric glare, the trickling water from his cap peak.
"Take his name, sergeant major,"
he says, passing on. The battalion stares rigidly ahead. Presently it sees the colonel, the two officers, and the sergeant major reappear in single file. At the proper place, the sergeant major halts and salutes the colonel's back. The colonel jerks his stick hand again and goes on, followed by the two officers, at a trot, toward the door from which he had emerged. The sergeant major faces the battalion again.
"Parade!"
he shouts. An indistinguishable movement passes from rank to rank, an indistinguishable precursor of that damp and sullen clash which dies borning. The sergeant major's stick has come down from his armpit. He now leans on it, as officers do. For a time his eye roves along the battalion front.
"Sergeant Cunningham,"
he says at last.
"Sir?" "Did you take that man's name?"
There is silence for a moment. A little more than a short moment, a little less than a long one. Then the sergeant says,
"What man, sir?" "You, soldier,"
the sergeant major says. The battalion stands rigid. The rain lances quietly into the mud between it and the sergeant major, as though it were too spent to either hurry or cease.
"You, soldier that don't shave,"
the sergeant major says.
"Gray, sir,"
the sergeant says.
"Gray, double out here."
The man Gray appears without haste and tramps stolidly before the battalion, his kilts dark and damp and heavy as a wet horse blanket. He halts, facing the sergeant major.
"Why didn't you shave this morning?"
the sergeant major says.
"I am nae old enough to shave,"
Gray says.
"Sir!"
the sergeant major says. Gray stares rigidly beyond the sergeant major's shoulder.
"Say, sir, when addressing a first-class warrant officer,"
the sergeant major says. Gray stares doggedly past his shoulder, his face beneath his visorless bonnet, as oblivious of the cold lances of rain as though it were granite. The sergeant major raises his voice.
Sergeant Cunningham!
Sir!
Take this man's name for insubordination also.
Very good, sir.
The sergeant major looks at Gray again.
And I'll see that you get the penal battalion, my man. Fall in.
Gray turns without haste and returns to his place in ranks, the sergeant major watching him. The sergeant major raises his voice again.
Sergeant Cunningham!
Sir!
You did not take that man's name when ordered. Let that happen again and you'll be for it yourself.
Very good, sir.
Carry on,
the sergeant major says.
But why did you no shave?
The corporal asked him. They were back in billets, a stone barn with leprous walls where no light entered, squatting in the ammoniac air on wet straw about a reeking brazier.
You kenned we were for inspection the morn. I am ne old enough to shave,
Gray said.
But you kenned the colonel would mark you on parade. I am ne old enough to shave,
Gray repeated doggedly and without heat.
For 200 years, Matthew Gray said, there's never a day, except Sunday, has passed, but there is a hull rising on Clyde or a hull going out of Clyde Mouth with a grey-driven nail in it.
He looked at young Alec across his steel spectacles, his neck bowed.
And not accepting their godless Sabbath hammering and sawing either. Because if a hull could be built in a day, Greys could build it,
he added with dour pride.
And now, when you are big enough to go down to the yards with your granddadder and me, and take a man's place among men, to be trusted manlike with hammer and saw yourself.
Whisht, Matthew,
old Alec said.
The lad can saw as straight a line and drive as mony a nail a day as yourself or even me.
Matthew paid his father no attention. He continued to speak his slow, considered words, watching his oldest son across the spectacles.
And with John Wesley not old enough by 2 years, and we Matthew by 10, and your grandfather an old man will soon be.
Whisht,
old Alec said.
I'm no but 68. Will you be telling the lad he'll make his bit journey to London and come back to find me in the parish house, mayhap? 'Twill be over by Christmastide.
Christmastide or no, Matthew said. A grey, a shipwright, has no business at an English war.
Whisht ye,
old Alec said. He rose and went to the chimney cupboard and returned, carrying a box. It was of wood, dark and polished with age, the corners bound with iron, and fitted with an enormous iron lock which any child with a hairpin could have solved. From his pocket, he took an iron key almost as big as the lock. He opened the box and lifted carefully out a small velvet-covered jeweler's box and opened it in turn. On the satin lining lay a medal, a bit of bronze on a crimson ribbon, a Victoria Cross.
I kept the hulls going out of Clydemouth while your Uncle Simon was getting this bit of brass from the Queen,
old Alec said.
I heard naught of complaint, and if need be, I'll keep them going out while Alec serves the Queen a bit himself.
Let the lad go,
he said. He put the medal back into the wooden box and locked it.
A bit of fighting wouldn't hurt the lad. If I were his age or yours either, for that matter, I'd gang myself. Alec, lad, hark ye. You'll see if they'll no take a hale lad of 68 and I'll gang wi' ye, and leave the old folk like Matthew to do the best they can. Nay, Matthew, dinna ye thwart the lad. Have no the Greys ever served the Queen in her need?
So young Alec went to enlist, descending the hill on a weekday in his Sunday clothes, with a New Testament and a loaf of home-baked bread tied in a handkerchief. And this was the last day's work which old Alec ever did. For soon after that, one morning Matthew descended the hill to the shipyard alone, leaving old Alec at home. And after that, on the sunny days, and sometimes on the bad days too, until his daughter-in-law found him and drove him back into the house, he would sit shawled in a chair on the porch, gazing south and eastward, calling now and then to his son's wife within the house.
Hark now! Do you hear them? The guns!
I hear nothing,
the daughter-in-law would say. It's only the sea at Kinkead Bight.
Come into the house now. Matthew will be displeased.
Whisht, woman. Do you think there is a grey in the world could let off a gun and me not know the sound of it?
They had a letter from him shortly after he enlisted, from England, in which he said that being a soldier, England, was different from being a shipwright, Clydeside, and that he would write again later. Which he did, each month or so, writing that soldiering was different from building ships, and that it was still raining. Then they did not hear from him for 7 months, but his mother and father continued to write him a joint letter on the first Monday of each month, letters almost identical with the previous one, the previous dozen.
We are well. Ships are going out of Clyde faster than they can sink them. You still have the book.
This would be in his father's slow, indomitable hand. Then in his mother's,
are you well? Do you need anything? Jessie and I are knitting the stockings and will send them. Alec, Alec.
He received this one during the 7 months, during his term in the penal battalion, forwarded to him by his old corporal, since he had not told his people of his changed life. He answered it, huddled among his fellow felons, squatting in the mud with newspapers buttoned inside his tunic and his head and feet wrapped in strips of torn blanket.
I am well. Yes, I still have the book.
Not telling them that his platoon was using it to light tobacco with, and that they were now well beyond lamentations.
It still rains. Love to Grandadder and Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley.
Then his time in the penal battalion was up. He returned to his old company, his old platoon, finding some new faces and a letter.
We are well. Ships are going out of Clyde yet. You have a new sister. Your mother is well.
He folded the letter and put it away.
I see many new faces in the battalion, he said to the corporal. We have a new sergeant major too, I doubt not.
No, the corporal said. 'Tis the same one.
He was looking at Gray, his gaze intent, speculative. His face cleared.
You have shaved the morn, he said.
Aye,
Gray said.
I'm old enough to shave now.
That was the night on which the battalion was to go up to Arras. It was to move at midnight, so he answered the letter at once.
I am well. Love to Grandadder and Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley and the baby.
Morning! Morning!
The general, lap-robed and hooded, leans from his motor and waves his gloved hand and shouts cheerily to them as they slog past the car on the Bapaume Road, taking the ditch to pass.
That's a cheery old card, a voice says.
Officers,
a second drawls. He falls to cursing as he slips in the grease-like mud, trying to cling to the crest of the knee-deep ditch.
Ah, well,
a third says.
The officers would gang to the war, too, I doubt not.
Why dinna they gang, then?
A fourth says.
The war is no back that way.
Platoon by platoon, they slip and plunge into the ditch and drag their heavy feet out of the clinging mud and past the halted car and crawl terrifically onto the crown of the road again.
I says, Fritz has a new gun that will carry to Paris, I says, and I says to him,
'Tis nothing. I has one that will hit our corps headquarters.
Morning, morning.
The general continues to wave his glove and shout cheerily as the battalion detours into the ditch and heaves itself back onto the road again. They are in the trench. Until the first rifle explodes in their faces, not a shot has been fired. Gray is the third man. During all the while that they crept between flares from shell hole to shell hole, he has been working himself nearer to the sergeant major and the officer. In the glare of that first rifle, he can see the gap in the wire toward which the officer was leading them, the moiled, rigid glints of the wire where bullets have nicked the mud and rust from it, and against the glare the tall, leaping shape of the sergeant major. Then Gray, too, springs bayonet first into the trench full of grunting shouts and thudding blows. Flares go up by dozens now. In the corpse glare, Gray sees the sergeant major methodically tossing grenades into the next traverse. He runs toward him, passing the officer leaning, bent double, against the fire step. The sergeant major has vanished beyond the traverse. Gray follows and comes upon the sergeant major. Holding the burlap curtain aside with one hand, the sergeant major is in the act of tossing a grenade into a dugout as if he might be tossing an orange hull into a cellar. The sergeant major turns in the rocket glare.
"'Tis you, Gray,"
he says. The earth-muffled bomb thuds. The sergeant major is in the act of catching another bomb from the sack about his neck as Gray's bayonet goes into his throat. The sergeant major is a big man. He falls backward, holding the rifle barrel with both hands against his throat, his teeth glaring, pulling Gray with him. Gray clings to the rifle. He tries to shake the speared body on the bayonet as he would shake a rat on an umbrella rib. He frees the bayonet. The sergeant major falls. Gray reverses the rifle and hammers its butt into the sergeant major's face, but the trench floor is too soft to supply any resistance. He glares about. His gaze falls upon a duckboard upended in the mud. He drags it free and slips it beneath the sergeant major's head and hammers the face with his rifle butt. Behind him, in the first traverse, the officer is shouting, "Blow your whistle, Sergeant Major!" In the citation, it told how Private Gray, on a night raid, one of four survivors, following the disablement of the officer and the death of all the NCOs, took command of the situation and, the purpose of the expedition was a quick raid for prisoners, held a foothold in the enemy's front line until a supporting attack arrived and consolidated the position. The officer told how he ordered the men back out, ordering them to leave and save themselves, and how Gray appeared with a German machine gun from somewhere and, while his three companions built a barricade, overcame the officer and took from him his very pistol and fired the colored signal which called for the attack, all so quickly that support arrived before the enemy could counterattack or put down a barrage. It is doubtful if his people ever saw the citation at all. Anyway, the letters which he received from them during his sojourn in hospital, the tenor of them, were unchanged. "We are well. Ships are still going out." His next letter home was once more months late. He wrote it when he was sitting up again in London. "I have been sick, but I am better now. I have a ribbon like in the box, but not all red. The Queen was there. Love to Grandadder and Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley and the baby." The reply was written on Friday. "Your mother is glad that you are better. Your grandfather is dead. The baby's name is Elizabeth. We are well. Your mother sends her love." His next letter was 3 months later, in winter again. "My hurt is well. I'm going to a school for officers. Love to Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley and Elizabeth." Matthew Gray pondered over this letter for a long while, so long that the reply was a week late, written on the second Monday instead of the first. He wrote it carefully, waiting until his family was in bed. It was such a long letter, or he had been at it so long, that after a time his wife came into the room in her nightdress. "Go back to bed," he told her. "I'll be coming soon. 'Tis something to be said to the lad." When at last he laid the pen down and sat back to reread the letter, it was a long one, written out slowly and deliberately, and without retraction or blot. "Your bit ribbon, for that way lies vainglory and pride, the pride and vainglory of going for an officer. Never miscall your birth, Alec. You are not a gentleman. You are a Scottish shipwright. If your grandfather were here, he would not be last to tell you so. We are glad your hurt is well. Your mother sends her love." He sent home the medal and his photograph in the new tunic with the pips and ribbon and the barred cuffs. but he did not go home himself. He returned to Flanders in the spring, with poppies blowing in the churned beet and cabbage fields. When his leaves came, he spent them in London, in the haunts of officers, not telling his people that he had any leave. He still had the book. Occasionally he came upon it among his effects and opened it at the jagged page where his life had changed. And a voice said, "Peter, raise thyself. Kill." Often his batman would watch him, as unawares and oblivious, he turned the book and mused upon the jagged page. The rancor, the gaunt, lonely man, with a face that belied his years or lack of them. A sobriety, a profound and mature calm, a grave and deliberate conviction of expression and gesture.
"Like a mout be Haig hissel,"
the batman said. Watching him, at his clean table, writing steadily and slowly, his tongue in his cheek, as a child writes. "I am well. It has not rained in a fortnight. Love to Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley and Elizabeth." 4 days ago, the battalion came down from the lines. It has lost its major and two captains, and most of the subalterns, so that now the remaining captain is major, and two subalterns and a sergeant have the companies. Meanwhile, replacements have come up, the ranks are filled, and the battalion is going in again tomorrow. So today, K Company stands with ranks open for inspection, while the subaltern captain, his name is Gray, moves slowly along each platoon front. He passes from man to man, slowly, thoroughly, the sergeant behind him. He stops.
"Where is your trenching tool?" he says.
"Blown," the soldier begins. Then he ceases, staring rigidly before him.
"Blown out of your pack, eh?" the captain finishes for him. "Since when? What battles have you taken part in since 4 days?"
The soldier stares rigidly across the drowsy street. The captain moves on.
"Take his name, sergeant."
He moves on to the second platoon, to the third. He halts again. He looks the soldier up and down.
"What is your name?" 010801, McLean, sir."
"Replacement?"
"Replacement, sir."
The captain moves on.
"Take his name, sergeant. Rifle's filthy."
The sun is setting. The village rises in black silhouette against the sunset. The river gleams in mirrored fire. The bridge across the river is a black arch upon which, slowly, and like figures cut from black paper, men are moving. The party crouches in the roadside ditch while the captain and the sergeant peer cautiously across the parapet of the road.
"Do you make them out?"
the captain says in a low voice.
"Huns, sir," the sergeant whispers. "I ken their helmets."
Presently the column has crossed the bridge. The captain and the sergeant crawl back into the ditch, where the party crouches. Among them, a wounded man with a bandaged head.
"Keep yon man quiet now," the captain says.
He leads the way along the ditch until they reach the outskirts of the village. Here they are out of the sun, and here they sit quietly beneath a wall, surrounding the wounded man, while the captain and the sergeant again crawl away. They return in 5 minutes.
"Fix bayonets," the sergeant says in a low voice. "Quiet now."
"Will I stay with the hurt lad, sergeant?"
one whispers.
"Nay," the sergeant says. "All takes chance with us. Forward."
They steal quietly along the wall behind the captain. The wall approaches at right angles to the street, the road which crosses the bridge. The captain raises his hand. They halt and watch him as he peers around the corner. They are opposite the bridgehead. It and the road are deserted. The village dreams quietly in the setting sun. Against the sky beyond the village, the dust of the retreating column hangs, turning to rose and gold. Then they hear a sound, a short, guttural word. Not 10 yards away and behind a ruined wall, leveled breast high and facing the bridge, Four men squat about a machine gun. The captain raises his hand again. They grasp their rifles. A rush of hobnails on cobblestones. A cry of astonishment cut sharply off. Blows. Short, hard breaths. Curses. Not a shot. The man with the bandaged head begins to laugh shrilly until someone hushes him with a hand that tastes like brass. Under the captain's direction, they bash in the door of the house and drag the gun and the four bodies into it. They hoist the gun upstairs and set it up in a window looking down upon the bridgehead. The sun sinks further. The shadows fall long and quiet across village and river. The man with the bandaged head babbles to himself. Another column swings up the road, dogged and orderly beneath coal-hod helmets. It crosses the bridge and passes on through the village. A party detaches itself from the rear of the column and splits into three squads. Two of them have machine guns, which they set up on opposite sides of the street, the near one utilizing the barricade behind which the other gun had been captured. The third squad returns to the bridge, carrying sapper's tools and explosive. The sergeant tells off six of the 19 men, who descend the stairs silently. The captain remains with the gun in the window. Again there is a brief rush, a scuffle, blows. From the window the captain sees the heads of the machine gun crew across the street turn. Then the muzzle of the gun swings, firing. The captain rakes them once with his gun. Then he sweeps with it the party on the bridge, watching it break like a covey of quail for the nearest wall. The captain holds the gun on them. They wilt, running, and dot the white road and become motionless. Then he swings the gun back to the gun across the street. It ceases. He gives another order. The remaining men, except the man with the bandage, run down the stairs. Half of them stop at the gun beneath the window and drag it around. The others dash on across the street toward the second gun. They are halfway across when the other gun rattles. The running men plunge as one in mid-step. Their kilts whip forward and bare their pale thighs. The gun rakes across the doorway where the others are freeing the first gun of bodies. As the captain sweeps his gun down again, dust puffs from the left side of the window. His gun rings metallically. Something sears along his arm and across his ribs. Dust puffs from the right side of the window. He rakes the other gun again. It ceases. He continues to fire into the huddled clump about it, long after the gun has ceased. The dark earth bites into the sun's rim. The street is now all in shadow. A final level ray comes into the room and fades. Behind him in the twilight, the wounded man laughs. Then his laughter sinks into a quiet, contented gibberish. Just before dark, another column crosses the bridge. There is still enough light for it to be seen that these troops wear khaki and that their helmets are flat. But likely there is no one to see, because when a party mounted to the second story and found the captain propped in the window beside the cold gun, they thought that he was dead. This time, Matthew Gray saw the citation. Someone clipped it from the Gazette and sent it to him, and he sent it in turn to his son in the hospital, with a letter. "Since you must go to a war, we are glad that you are doing well in it. Your mother thinks that you have done your part and that you should come home. But women do not understand such things. But I myself think that it is time they stopped fighting. What is the good in the high wages when food is so high that there is profit for none save the profiteers? When a war gets to where the battles do not even prosper the people who win them, it is time to stop." In the bed next his, and later in the chair next his on the long glassed veranda, there was a subaltern. They used to talk, or rather, the subaltern talked while Gray listened. He talked of peace, of what he would do when it was over, talking as if it were about finished, as if it would not last past Christmas. "We'll be back out there by Christmas," Gray said. "Gas cases? They don't send gas cases out again. They have to be cured." "We will be cured." "But not in time. It will be over by Christmas. It can't last another year. You don't believe me, do you? Sometimes I believe you want to go back, but it will be. It will be finished by Christmas. And then I'm off. Canada. Nothing at home for us now. He looked at the other, at the gaunt, wasted figure with almost white hair, lying with closed eyes in the fall sunlight. You'd better come with me. I'll meet you in Givenchy on Christmas Day, Gray said. But he didn't. He was in the hospital on the 11th of November, hearing the bells, and he was still there on Christmas Day, where he received a letter from home. You can come on home now. It will not be too soon now. They will need ships worse than ever now, now that the pride and the vainglory have worn themselves out. The medical officer greeted him cheerfully. Damn it! Stuck here, when I know a place in Devon where I could hear a nightingale, by Jove! He thumped Gray's chest. Not much, just a bit of a murmur. Give you no trouble if you'll stop away from wars from now on. Might keep you from getting in again, though. He waited for Gray to laugh, but Gray didn't laugh. Well, it's all finished now, damn them. Sign here, will you? Gray signed. Forget it as quickly as it began, I hope. Well, he extended his hand, smiling his antiseptic smile. Cheero, Captain, and good luck. Matthew Gray, descending the hill at 7 o'clock in the morning, saw the man, the tall, hospital-colored man in city clothing and carrying a stick, and stopped. Alec? He said. Alec! They shook hands. I did not... He looked at his son, at the white hair, the waxed mustaches. You have two ribbons now for the box you have written. Then Matthew turned back up the hill at 7 o'clock in the morning. We'll go to your mother. Then Alec Gray reverted for an instant. Perhaps he had not progressed as far as he thought, or perhaps he had been climbing a hill, and the return was not a reversion so much as something like an avalanche waiting the pebble, momentary though it was to be. The shipyard, father. His father strode firmly on, carrying his lunch pail. "'Twill wait,' he said. "'We'll go to your mother.' His mother met him at the door. Behind her he saw young Matthew, a man now, and John Wesley, and Elizabeth, whom he had never seen. "'You did not wear your uniform home,' young Matthew said. "'No,' he said. "'No, I—' "'Your mother had wanted to see you in your regimentals and all,' his father said. No, his mother said. No, never, never. Hush, Annie, his father said. Being a captain now with two ribbons now for the box. This is false modesty. Ye have shown courage. Ye should have... But 'tis of no moment. The proper uniform for a Gray is an overall and a hammer.
Aye, sir, Alec said, who had long since found out that no man has courage, but that any man may blunder blindly into valor, as one stumbles into an open manhole in the street. He did not tell his father until that night, after his mother and the children had gone to bed. I am going back to England. I have work promised there.
Ah, his father said. At Bristol, perhaps. They build ships there.
The lamp glowed, touching with faint gleams the black and polished surface of the box on the mantelshelf. There was a wind getting up, hollowing out the sky like a dark bowl, carving house and hill and headland out of dark space.
"'Twill be blowing out yon the night,' his father said.
"'There are other things,' Alec said. "'I have made friends, you see.' His father removed the iron-rimmed spectacles.
You have made friends. Officers and such, I doubt not.
Yes, sir.
And friends are good to have, to sit about the hearth of nights and talk with. But beyond that, only them that love you will bear your faults. You must love a man well to put up with all his trying ways, Alec.
But they are not that sort of friends, sir. They are... He ceased. He did not look at his father. Matthew sat, slowly polishing the spectacles with his thumb. They could hear the wind. "If this fails, I'll come back to the shipyard." His father watched him gravely, polishing the spectacles slowly.
"Shipwrights are not made like that, Alec. To fear God, to do your work like it was your own hull you were putting the ribs in."
He moved.
"We'll see what the book will say."
He replaced the glasses. On the table was a heavy, brass-bound Bible. He opened it. The words seemed to him to rise to meet him from the page. Yet he read them aloud.
"And the captains of thousands, and the captains of 10,000s.
A paragraph of pride. He faced his son, bowing his neck to see across the glasses.
"You will go to London then?"
"Yes, sir,"
Alec said. His position was waiting. It was in an office. He had already had cards made. Captain A. Gray, M.C., D.S.M. And on his return to London, he joined the Officers' Association, donating to the support of the widows and orphans. He had rooms in the proper quarter, and he would walk to and from the office with his cards and his waxed mustaches, his sober, correct clothes, and his stick carried in a manner inimitable, at once jaunty and unobtrusive, giving his coppers to blind and maimed in Piccadilly, asking of them the names of their regiments. Once a month he wrote home,
"I am well. Love to Jesse and Matthew and John Wesley and Elizabeth."
During that first year, Jesse was married. He sent her a gift of plate, stinting himself a little to do so, drawings from his savings. He was saving, not against old age. He believed too firmly in the Empire to do that, who had surrendered completely to the Empire like a woman, a bride. He was saving against the time when he would recross the Channel among the dead scenes of his lost and found life. That was 3 years later. He was already planning to ask for leave when one day the manager broached the subject himself. With one correct bag, he went to France. But he did not bear eastward at once. He went to the Riviera. For a week he lived like a gentleman, spending his money like a gentleman, lonely, alone in that bright aviary of the svelte-kept women of all Europe. That was why those who saw him descend from the Mediterranean Express that morning in Paris said,
"Here is a rich milord,"
and why they continued to say it in the hard-benched third-class trains as he sat leaning forward on his stick, lip-moving the names on sheet-iron stations about the battered and waking land lying now 3 years quiet beneath the senseless and unbroken battalions of days. He reached London and found what he should have known before he left. His position was gone. "Conditions," the manager told him, addressing him punctiliously by his rank. What savings he had left melted slowly. He spent the last of them on a black silk dress for his mother, with the letter, "I am well. Love to Matthew and John Wesley and Elizabeth." He called upon his friends, upon the officers whom he had known. One, the man he knew best, gave him whiskey in a comfortable room with a fire.
"You aren't working now?"
"Rotten luck.
By the way, you remember Whiteby? He had a company in the... Nice chap. No people, though. He killed himself last week. Conditions."
"Oh, did he?"
"Yes, I remember him.
Rotten luck."
"Yes, rotten luck. Nice chap."
He no longer gave his pennies to the blind and the maimed in Piccadilly. He needed them for papers. Artisans needed. Become stonemason. Men to drive motor cars. War record not necessary. Shop assistants. Must be under 21. Shipwrights needed. And at last, gentlemen with social address and connections to meet out-of-town clients. Temporary. He got the place, and with his waxed mustaches and his correct clothes, he revealed the fleshpots of the West End to Birmingham and Leeds. It was temporary. Artisans, carpenters, house painters. Winter was temporary, too. In the spring, he took his waxed mustaches and his ironed clothes into Surrey with a set of books, an encyclopedia, on commission. He sold all his things, save what he stood in, and gave up his rooms in town. He still had his stick, his waxed mustaches, his cards. Surrey. Gentle, green, mild. A tight little house in a tight little garden. An oldish man in a smoking jacket, puttering in a flower bed.
"Good day, sir. Might I..."
The man in the smoking jacket looks up.
"Go to the side, can't you? Don't come this way."
He goes to the side entrance, a slatted gate, freshly white, bearing an enameled plate. No hawkers, beggars. He passes through and knocks at a tidy door, smug beneath a vine.
"Good day, miss. May I see the..."
"Go away. Didn't you see the sign on the gate?"
"But I..."
"Go away, or I'll call the master."
In the fall, he returned to London. Perhaps he could not have said why himself. Perhaps it was beyond any saying, instinct perhaps bringing him back to be present at the instant out of all time of the manifestation, apotheosis, of his life, which had died again. Anyway, he was there, still with his waxed mustaches, erect, his stick clasped beneath his left armpit, among the household troops in brass cuirasses, on dappled geldings, and guards in scarlet tunics, and the church militant in stole and surplice, and prince defenders of God in humble mufti, all at attention for 2 minutes, listening to despair. He still had 30 shillings, and he replenished his cards. Captain A. Gray, M.C., D.S.M. It is one of those spurious, pale days, like a sickly and premature child of spring, while spring itself is still weeks away. In the thin sunlight, buildings fade upward into misty pinks and golds. Women wear violets pinned to their furs, appearing to bloom themselves, like flowers, in the languorous, treacherous air. It is the women who look twice at the man standing against the wall at a corner, a gaunt man with white hair and mustaches twisted into frayed points, with a bleached and frayed regimental scarf in a celluloid collar, a once good suit now threadbare, yet apparently pressed within 24 hours, standing against the wall with closed eyes, a dilapidated hat held bottom up before him. He stood there for a long time, until someone touched his arm. It was a constable.
"Move along, sir. Against orders."
In his hat were 7 pennies and 3 halfpence. He bought a cake of soap and a little food. Another anniversary came and passed. He stood again, his stick at his armpit, among the bright, silent uniforms, the quiet throng in either frank or stubborn cast-offs, with patient, bewildered faces. In his eyes now is not that hopeful resignation of a beggar, but rather that bitterness, that echo as of bitter and unheard laughter of a hunchback. A meager fire burns on the sloping cobbles. In the fitful light, the damp, fungus-grown wall of the embankment and the stone arch of the bridge loom. At the foot of the cobbled slope, the invisible river clucks and gurgles with the tide. 5 figures lie about the fire, some with heads covered as though in slumber, others smoking and talking. One man sits upright, his back to the wall, his hands lying beside him. He is blind. He sleeps that way. He says that he is afraid to lie down.
"Can't you tell you are lying down without seeing you are?" another says.
"Something might happen," the blind man says.
"What? Do you think they would give you a shell, even if it would bring back your sight?"
"They'd give him the shell all right," a third said.
"Oh, Why don't they line us all up and put down a bloody barrage on us?
Was that how he lost his sight? A fourth says. A shell?
Dah!
He was at Mons, a dispatch rider on a motorbike. Tell them about it, mate.
The blind man lifts his face a little. Otherwise, he does not move. He speaks in a flat voice. She had the bit of scar on her wrist. That was how I could tell. It was me put the scar on her wrist, you might say. We was working in the shop one day. I had picked up an old engine and we was fitting it onto a bike so we could...
What?
The fourth says.
What's he talking about?
Shh!
The first says.
Not so loud. He's talking about his girl.
He had a bit of a bike shop on the Brighton Road and they were going to marry. He speaks in a low tone, his voice just under the weary, monotonous voice of the blind man.
Had their picture taken, and all the day he enlisted and got his uniform. He had it with him for a while, until one day he lost it. He was fair wild. So at last we got a bit of a card about the same size of the picture.
Here's your picture, mate, we says. Hold on to it this time.
So he's still got the card. Likely he'll show it to you before he's done, so don't you let on.
No, the other says, I shan't let on. The blind man talks.
Got them at the hospital to write her a letter, and sure enough, here she come. I could tell her by the bit of scar on her wrist. Her voice sounded different, but then everything sounded different since. But I could tell by the scar. We would sit and hold hands, and I could touch the bit of scar inside her left wrist. In the cinema, too. I would touch the scar, and it would be like I...
The cinema?
The fourth says.
Him?
Yes, the other says. She would take him to the cinema, the comedies, so he could hear them laughing. The blind man talks. Told me how the pictures hurt her eyes, and that she would leave me at the cinema, and when it was over she would come and fetch me. So I said it was all right. And the next night it was again. And I said it was all right. And the next night, I told her I wouldn't go either. I said we would stop at home, at the hospital. And then she didn't say anything for a long while. I could hear her breathing. Then she said it was all right. So after that, we didn't go to the cinema. We would just sit, holding hands, and me feeling the scar now and then. We couldn't talk loud in the hospital. So we would whisper. But mostly we didn't talk. We just held hands. And that was for 8 nights. I counted. Then it was the 8th night. We were sitting there, with the other hand in my hand, and me touching the scar now and then. Then on a sudden, the hand jerked away. I could hear her standing up. Listen, she says. This can't go on any longer. You will have to know sometime, she says. And I says, I don't want to know but one thing. What is your name? I says. She told me her name, one of the nurses. And she says,
what?
The fourth says.
What is this?
He told you, the first said. It was one of the nurses in the hospital. The girl had been buggering off with another fellow and left the nurse for him to hold her hand. Thinking he was fooled.
But how did he know?
The fourth says.
Listen,
the first says.
And you knew all the time, she says. Since the first time.
It was the scar, I says. You've got it on the wrong wrist. You've got it on your right wrist, I says. And 2 nights ago, I lifted up the edge of it a bit.
What is it,
I says. Court plaster?
The blind man sits against the wall, his face lifted a little, his hands motionless beside him.
That's how I knew, by the scar. Thinking they could fool me, when it was me put the scar on her, you might say.
The prone figure, farthest from the fire, lifts its head.
Up, he says. Here he comes.
The others turn as one and look toward the entrance.
Here who comes? The blind man says. Is it the bobbies?
They do not answer. They watch the man who enters, a tall man with a stick. They cease to talk, save the blind man, watching the tall man come among them.
"Here who comes, mates?" the blind man says. "Mates!"
The newcomer passes them and the fire. He does not look at them. He goes on.
"Watch now," the second says.
The blind man is now leaning a little forward. His hands fumble at the ground beside him as though he were preparing to rise.
"Watch who?" he says. "What do you see?"
They do not answer. They are watching the newcomer, covertly, attentively, as he disrobes and then, a white shadow, a ghostly gleam in the darkness, goes down to the water and washes himself, slapping his body hard with icy and filthy handfuls of river water. He returns to the fire. They turn their faces quickly aside, save the blind man. He still sits forward, his arms propped beside him as though on the point of rising, his wan face turned toward the sound, the movement, and one other.
"Your stones is hot, sir," this one says. "I've had them right in the blaze."
"Thanks," the newcomer says. He still appears to be utterly oblivious of them, so they watch him again, quietly, as he spreads his sorry garments on one stone and takes a second stone from the fire and irons them. While he is dressing, the man who spoke to him goes down to the water and returns with the cake of soap which he had used. Still watching, they see the newcomer rub his fingers on the cake of soap and twist his mustaches into points.
"A bit more on the left one, sir," the man holding the soap says.
The newcomer soaps his fingers and twists his left mustache again, the other man watching him, his head bent and tilted a little back, in shape and attitude and dress, like a caricatured scarecrow.
"Right now?" the newcomer says.
"Right, sir,"
the scarecrow says. He retreats into the darkness and returns without the cake of soap, and carrying instead the hat and the stick. The newcomer takes them. From his pocket he takes a coin and puts it into the scarecrow's hand. The scarecrow touches his cap. The newcomer is gone. They watch him. The tall shape, the erect back, the stick, until he disappears.
"What do you see, mates?" the blind man says. "Tell a man what you see."
Among the demobilized officers who emigrated from England after the armistice was a subaltern named Walkley. He went out to Canada, where he raised wheat and prospered, both in pocket and in health. So much so that, had he been walking out of the Gare de Lyon in Paris instead of in Piccadilly Circus on this first evening, it is Christmas Eve, of his first visit home, they would have said,
"Here is not only a rich milord, it is a well one."
He had been in London just long enough to outfit himself with the beginning of a wardrobe, and in his new clothes, bought of a tailor which in the old days he could not have afforded, he was enjoying himself too much to even go anywhere. So he just walked the streets among the cheerful throngs until suddenly he stopped dead still, staring at a face. The man had almost white hair, mustaches waxed to needle points. He wore a frayed scarf in which could be barely distinguished the colors and pattern of a regiment. His threadbare clothes were freshly ironed, and he carried a stick. He was standing at the curb, and he appeared to be saying something to the people who passed, and Walkley moved suddenly forward, his hand extended. But the other man only stared at him with eyes that were perfectly dead.
"Gray,"
Walkley said.
"Don't you remember me?"
The other stared at him with that dead intensity.
"We were in hospital together. I went out to Canada. Don't you remember?"
"Yes," the other said.
"I remember you. You are Walkley."
Then he quit looking at Walkley. He moved a little aside, turning to the crowd again, his hand extended. It was only then that Walkley saw that the hand contained 3 or 4 boxes of the matches which may be bought from any tobacconist for a penny a box.
"Matches? Matches, sir?" he said.
Matches? Matches? Walkley moved also, getting again in front of the other.
Grey, he said.
The other looked at Walkley again, this time with a kind of restrained yet raging impatience.
Let me alone, you son of a bitch,
he said, turning immediately toward the crowd again, his hand extended.
Matches? Matches, sir?
He chanted. Walkley moved on. He paused again, half turning, looking back at the gaunt face above the waxed mustaches. Again the other looked him full in the face, but the glance passed on, as though without recognition. Walkley went on. He walked swiftly.
My God, he said. I think I'm going to vomit.
Crevasse. The party goes on, skirting the edge of the barrage, weaving down into shell craters old and new, crawling out again. Two men half drag, half carry between them a third, while two others carry the three rifles. The third man's head is bound in a bloody rag. He stumbles his aimless legs along, his head lolling, sweat channeling slowly down his mud-crusted face. The barrage stretches on and on across the plain, distant, impenetrable. Occasionally a small wind comes up from nowhere and thins the dun smoke momentarily upon clumps of bitten poplars. The party enters and crosses a field which a month ago was sown to wheat, and where yet wheat spears thrust and cling stubbornly in the churned soil among scraps of metal and seething hunks of cloth. It crosses the field and comes to a canal bordered with tree stumps, sheared roughly at a symmetrical 5-foot level. The men flop and drink of the contaminated water and fill their water bottles. The two bearers let the wounded man slip to earth. He hangs lax on the canal bank, with both arms in the water and his head too, had not the others held him up. One of them raises water in his helmet, but the wounded man cannot swallow. So they set him upright, and the other holds the helmet brim to his lips and refills the helmet and pours the water on the wounded man's head, sopping the bandage. Then he takes a filthy rag from his pocket and dries the wounded man's face with clumsy gentleness. The captain, the subaltern, and the sergeant, still standing, are poring over a soiled map. Beyond the canal, the ground rises gradually, the canal cutting reveals the chalk formation of the land in pallid strata. The captain puts the map away and the sergeant speaks the men to their feet, not loud. The two bearers raise the wounded man and they follow the canal bank, coming after a while to a bridge formed by a waterlogged barge hull lashed bow and stern to either bank, and so pass over. Here they halt again, while once more the captain and the subaltern consult the map. Gunfire comes across the pale spring noon like a prolonged clashing of hail on an endless metal roof. As they go on, the chalky soil rises gradually underfoot. The ground is dryly rough, shaling, and the going is harder still for the two who carry the wounded man. But when they would stop, the wounded man struggles and wrenches free and staggers on alone, his hands at his head, and stumbles, falling. The bearers catch and raise him, and hold him muttering between them and wrenching his arms. He is muttering,
Bonnet,
and he frees his hands and tugs again at his bandage. The commotion passes forward. The captain looks back and stops. The party halts also, unbidden, and lowers rifles.
It's Picanat's bandage, sir,
one of the bearers tells the captain. They let the man sit down between them. The captain kneels beside him.
Bonnet, bonnet,
the man mutters. The captain loosens the bandage. The sergeant extends a water bottle and the captain wets the bandage and lays his hand on the man's brow. The others stand about, looking on with a kind of sober, detached interest. The captain rises. The bearers raise the wounded man again. The sergeant speaks them into motion. They gain the crest of the ridge.
The ridge slopes westward into a plateau, slightly rolling. Southward, beneath its dun pall, the barrage still rages. Westward and northward about the shining empty plain, smoke rises lazily here and there above clumps of trees. But this is the smoke of burning things, burning wood, and not powder. And the two officers gaze from beneath their hands, the men halting again without order and lowering arms.
"Gad, sir,"
the subaltern says suddenly in a high, thin voice.
"It's houses burning. They're retreating. Beasts! Beasts!"
"'Tis possible," the captain says, gazing beneath his hand. "We can get around that barrage now. Should be a road just yonder."
He strides on again.
"Forward,"
the sergeant says, in that tone, not loud. The men slope arms once more with unquestioning docility. The ridge is covered with a tough, gorse-like grass. Insects buzz in it, zip from beneath their feet and fall to slatting again beneath the shimmering moon. The wounded man is babbling again. At intervals they pause and give him water and wet the bandage again. Then two others exchange with the bearers, and they hurry the man on and close up again. The head of the line stops. The men jolt, prodding into one another like a train of freight cars stopping. At the captain's feet lies a broad, shallow depression in which grows a sparse, dead-looking grass, like clumps of bayonets thrust up out of the earth. It is too big to have been made by a small shell, and too shallow to have been made by a big one. It bears no traces of having been made by anything at all, and they look quietly down into it.
"Queer," the subaltern says. "What do you fancy could have made it?"
The captain does not answer. He turns. They circle the depression, looking down into it quietly as they pass it. But they have no more than passed it when they come upon another one, perhaps not quite so large.
"I didn't know they had anything that could make that," the subaltern says.
Again the captain does not answer. They circle this one also and keep on along the crest of the ridge. On the other hand, the ridge shears sharply downward, stratum by stratum of pallid, eroded chalk. A shallow ravine gashes its crumbling yawn abruptly across their path. The captain changes direction again, paralleling the ravine, until shortly afterward the ravine turns at right angles and goes on in the direction of their march. The floor of the ravine is in shadow. The captain leads the way down the shelving wall into the shade. They lower the wounded man carefully and go on. After a time, the ravine opens. They find that they have debouched into another of those shallow depressions. This one is not so clearly defined, though, and the opposite wall of it is nicked by what is apparently another depression, like two overlapping discs. They cross the first depression, while more of the dead-looking grass bayonets saber their legs dryly and pass through the gap into the next depression. This one is like a miniature valley between miniature cliffs. Overhead they can see only the drowsy and empty bowl of the sky, with a few faint smoke smudges to the northwest. The sound of the barrage is now remote and far away, a vibration in earth felt rather than heard. There are no recent shell craters or marks here at all. It is as though they had strayed suddenly into a region, a world where the war had not reached, where nothing had reached, where no life is, and silence itself is dead. They give the wounded man water and go on. The valley, the depression, strays vaguely before them. They can see that it is a series of overlapping, vaguely circular basins formed by no apparent or deducible agency. Pallid grass bayonets saber at their legs, and after a time they are again among old healed scars of trees, to which there cling sparse leaves, neither green nor dead, as if they too had been overtaken and caught by a hiatus in time, gossiping dryly among themselves, though there is no wind. The floor of the valley is not level. It in itself descends into vague depressions, rises again as vaguely between its shelving walls. In the center of these smaller depressions, whitish knobs of chalk thrust up through the thin topsoil. The ground has a resilient quality, like walking on cork.
feet, make no sound. Jolly walking, the subaltern says. Though his voice is not raised, it fills the small valley with the abruptness of a thunderclap, filling the silence, the words seeming to hang about them, as though silence here had been so long undisturbed that it had forgot its purpose. As one they look quietly and soberly about, at the shelving walls, the stubborn ghosts of trees, the bland, hushed sky. Topping hole-up for embuscade birds and such, the subaltern says. Aye, the captain says. His word, in turn, hangs sluggishly and fades. The men at the rear close up, the movement passing forward, the men looking quietly and soberly about. But no birds here, the subaltern says. No insects, even.
Aye,
the captain says. The word fades. The silence comes down again. Sunny. Profoundly still. The subaltern pauses and stirs something with his foot. The men halt also, and the subaltern and the captain, without touching it, examine the half-buried and moldering rifle. The wounded man is babbling again.
What is it, sir?
The subaltern says.
Looks like one of those things the Canadians had.
A Ross, right?
French, the captain says. 1914.
Oh, the subaltern says. He turns the rifle aside with his toe. The bayonet is still attached to the barrel, but the stock has long since rotted away. They go on across the uneven ground, among the chalky knobs thrusting up through the soil. Light, the wan and drowsy sunlight, is laked in the valley, stagnant, bodiless, without heat. The saber-like grass thrusts sparsely and rigidly upward. They look about again at the shaling walls. Then the ones at the head of the party watch the subaltern pause and prod with his stick at one of the chalky knobs and turn presently upward its earth-stained eye sockets and its unbottomed grin.
Forward,
the captain says sharply. The party moves. The men look quietly and curiously at the skull as they pass. They go on, among the other whitish knobs, like marbles studded at random in the shallow soil.
All in the same position. Do you notice, sir?
The subaltern says, his voice chattily cheerful.
All upright. Queer way to bury chaps, sitting down. Shallow, too.
Aye, the captain says. The wounded man babbles steadily. The two bearers stop with him, but the others crowd on after the officers, passing the two bearers and the wounded man.
"Dinna stop to gie us sup water," one of the bearers says. "I'll drink walkin'."
They take up the wounded man again and hurry him on while one of them tries to hold the neck of a water bottle to the wounded man's mouth, clattering it against his teeth and spilling the water down the front of his tunic. The captain looks back.
"What's this?"
he says sharply. The men crowd up. Their eyes are wide, sober. He looks about at the quiet, intent faces.
What's the matter back there, sergeant?
Wind up, the subaltern says. He looks about at the eroded walls, the whitish knobs thrusting quietly out of the earth.
Feel it myself, he says.
He laughs, his laughter a little thin, ceasing.
Let's get out of here, sir,
he says.
Let's get into the sun again.
You are in the sun here, the captain says.
Ease off there, men. Stop crowding. We'll be out soon. We'll find the road and get past the barrage and make contact again.
He turns and goes on. The party gets into motion again. Then they all stop as one, in the attitudes of walking, in an utter suspension, and stare at one another. Again the earth moves under their feet. A man screams, high, like a woman or a horse. As the firm earth shifts for a third time beneath them, the officers whirl and see beyond the down-plunging man a gaping hole with dry dust still crumbling about the edges before the orifice crumbles again beneath a second man. Then a crack springs like a sword slash beneath them all. The earth breaks under their feet and tilts like jagged squares of pale fudge, framing a black yawn out of which, Like a silent explosion bursts the unmistakable smell of rotted flesh. While they scramble and leap, in silence now, there has been no sound since the first man screamed. From one cake to another, the cakes tilt and slide until the whole floor of the valley rushes slowly under them and plunges them downward into darkness. A grave rumbling rises into the sunlight on a blast of decay and of faint dust, which hangs and drifts in the faint air about the black orifice. The captain feels himself plunging down a sheer and shifting wall of moving earth, of sounds of terror and of struggling in the ink dark. Someone else screams. The scream ceases. He hears the voice of the wounded man coming thin and reiterant out of the plunging bowels of decay.
"I'm no dead! I'm no dead!"
And ceasing abruptly, as if a hand had been laid on his mouth. Then the moving cliff down which the captain plunges slopes gradually off and shoots him uninjured onto a hard floor, where he lies for a time on his back, while across his face the lightward and airward seeking blast of death and dissolution rushes. He has fetched up against something. It tumbles down upon him lightly, with a muffled clatter, as if it had come to pieces. Then he begins to see the light, the jagged shape of the cavern mouth, high overhead. And then the sergeant is bending over him with a pocket torch.
"Mackay?" the captain says.
For reply, the sergeant turns the flash upon his own face.
"Where's Mr. Mackay?" the captain says.
"He's gone, sir,"
the sergeant says in a husky whisper. The captain sits up.
"How many are left?"
14, sir,"
the sergeant whispers.
14? 12 missing. We'll have to dig fast."
He gets to his feet. The faint light from above falls coldly upon the heaped avalanche, upon the 13 helmets and the white bandage of the wounded man huddled about the foot of the cliff.
"Where are we?"
For answer, the sergeant moves the torch. It streaks laterally into the darkness along a wall, a tunnel, into yawning blackness, the walls faceted with pale glints of chalk. About the tunnel, sitting or leaning upright against the walls, are skeletons in dark tunics and bagging zouave trousers, their moldering arms beside them. The captain recognizes them as Senegalese troops of the May fighting of 1915. Surprised and killed by gas, probably, in the attitudes in which they had taken refuge in the chalk caverns. He takes the torch from the sergeant.
"We'll see if there's anyone else," he says. "Have out the trenching tools."
He flashes the light upon the precipice. It rises into gloom, darkness, then into the faint rumor of daylight overhead. With the sergeant behind him, he climbs the shifting heap, the earth sighing beneath him and shaling downward. The injured man begins to wail again,
"I'm no dead! I'm no dead!"
until his voice goes into a high, sustained screaming. Someone lays a hand over his mouth. His voice is muffled. Then it becomes laughter on a rising note, becomes screaming again, is choked again. The captain and the sergeant mount as high as they dare, prodding at the earth while the earth shifts beneath them in long, hushed sighs. At the foot of the precipice the men huddle, their faces lifted, faint, white, and patient into the light. The captain sweeps the torch up and down the cliff. There is nothing, no arm, no hand in sight. The air is clearing slowly.
"We'll get on," the captain says.
"Aye, sir,"
the sergeant says. In both directions, the cavern fades into darkness, plumbless and profound, filled with the quiet skeletons sitting and leaning against the walls, their arms beside them.
"The cave-in threw us forward," the captain says.
"Aye, sir,"
the sergeant whispers.
"Speak out," the captain says. "It's but a bit of a cave. If men got into it, we can get out."
"Aye, sir,"
the sergeant whispers.
"If it threw us forward, the entrance will be yonder."
"Aye, sir,"
the sergeant whispers. The captain flashes the torch ahead,
The men rise and huddle quietly behind him, the wounded man among them. He whimpers. The cavern goes on, unrolling its glinted walls out of the darkness. The sitting shapes grin quietly into the light as they pass. The air grows heavier. Soon they are trotting, gasping. Then the air grows lighter and the torch sweeps up another slope of earth, closing the tunnel. The men halt and huddle. The captain mounts the slope. He snaps off the light and crawls slowly along the crest of the slide, where it joins the ceiling of the cavern. Sniffing. The light flashes on again.
Two men with trenching tools, he says.
Two men mount to him. He shows them the fissure, through which air seeps in small, steady breaths. They begin to dig furiously, hurling the dirt back. Presently they are relieved by two others. Presently the fissure becomes a tunnel, and four men can work at once. The air becomes fresher. They burrow furiously, with whimpering cries like dogs. The wounded man, hearing them perhaps, catching the excitement perhaps, begins to laugh again, meaningless and high. Then the man at the head of the tunnel bursts through. Light rushes in around him like water. He burrows madly. In silhouette they see his wallowing buttocks lunge from sight, and a burst of daylight surges in. The others leave the wounded man and surge up the slope, fighting and snarling at the opening. The sergeant springs after them and beats them away from the opening with a trenching spade, cursing in his hoarse whisper.
"Let them go, sergeant," the captain says.
The sergeant desists. He stands aside and watches the men scramble into the tunnel. Then he descends, and he and the captain help the wounded man up the slope. At the mouth of the tunnel, the wounded man rebels.
"I'm no dead! I'm no dead!" he wails, struggling.
By cajolery and force, they thrust him, still wailing and struggling, into the tunnel, where he becomes docile again and scuttles through.
"Out with you, sergeant," the captain says.
"After you, sir,"
the sergeant whispers.
"Out with you, man,"
the captain says. The sergeant enters the tunnel. The captain follows. He emerges onto the outer slope of the avalanche which had closed the cave, at the foot of which the 14 men are kneeling in a group. On his hands and knees like a beast, the captain breathes, his breath making a hoarse sound.
"Soon it will be summer," he thinks,
dragging the air into his lungs faster than he can empty them to respire again.
"Soon it will be summer, and the long days."
At the foot of the slope, the 14 men kneel. The one in the center has a Bible in his hand, from which he is intoning monotonously. Above his voice, the wounded man's gibberish rises, meaningless and unemphatic and sustained.